we will be granting, if this is all approved, we will be granting recognition for a number of their own geographic indications. What are these? I think you know them in wines and spirits. Champagne is a name that is reserved for sparkling wine that comes from the Champagne region of France, but it goes a bit further. Cheddar cheese is now going to be reserved, well, feta cheese is the one we're really talking about, but will existing producers of feta cheese in South Africa will be allowed to keep the name, but no new entrants will be able to. That's the kind of concession that we made on this, and also allowed a few agricultural products which have not strategically significant in. That agreement we will have to take a call on. We'll have to make a call of government. The negotiations are now over. This is what's available. And then obviously it'll come through the parliamentary processes and everything. But I just wanted to alert everyone that the EPA is on the horizon. The Africa Growth and Opportunity Act is up for renewal. This is a non-reciprocal set of preferences that we, along with other African countries, get into the United States. It lapses next year, and the U.S. is now debating what it will provide in its place. We, along with other African countries, will go to the, in August, the Obama administration will announce its approach to that, and also to South Africa's inclusion. There are mixed signals from the U.S. Congress, a long list of complaints from the U.S. Congress, and all sorts of attempts to try to graduate us out. But the African position is that we want to roll over pretty much of what's there. But that will be something that we'll all be a little bit clearer about towards the end of the year. Just to say that our message on this, if you look at our trade with the U.S. has grown. It's a bit different from the EU. It's recovered. It's fairly balanced, and it includes a proportion of value-added products. We have said, look at this strategically. We have said it, to President Obama downwards. Look at it strategically, and you should say that this is a kind of trade relationship with South Africa that you want to support. This should be what's on the cards. However, we get a lot of vested interest in Congress saying, oh, but you treat chickens from the EU better than you treat chickens from us, and there's pork, and there's this, and there's that. So we're down to a number of individual product lines and interests and things like that, and we're going to have to navigate our way through that. The tripartite SADC, Southern African Development Community, COMESA, Common Market of Eastern and Southern Africa, East African Community, the negotiations for the free trade area, which I said was our flagship program of a large free trade area, it's gone past yesterday, was the deadline for conclusion, according to what the heads of state said. The trade minister said, give us 3 to 5 years. The heads of state said, you've got 3 years. That's finished yesterday. And so we haven't concluded. We don't think it's a trade smash, but we have to ensure that we do address the issues, because there are going to be all kinds of people saying this is the way to solve it. But the real issue is that we've defined the level of ambition, the nature of the agreement. We're not going to reopen, for example, the SADC free trade agreement, but we're going to negotiate between members of this bigger group with whom we don't have any preferential agreements. And the level of ambition has broadly been defined. But now we're in the phase of making offers and requests of each other, and some of the smaller players are finding it difficult to come to play with the offers and requests. That's a matter that we're going to have to address to move this process forward. We've got some significant challenges in SADC, where we see that some of the commitments of a number of countries in terms of the trade in terms of the SADC free trade area are not being honoured, and we're going to take those up. In the Southern African Customs Union, we've got to confront a real challenge of how do we move towards common understandings about the way tariff policies are set, but in such a way that it doesn't disadvantage us, who are the main users of tariffs, and how do we address then also the question of the continued supply of fairly large amounts of money under the revenue sharing arrangement, some of which is supposed to be compensation for loss of policy space, policy discretion, and so on. We have fairly different views about what tariff policy is about, and huge demands from other countries that we must just go towards a common a process of setting tariffs. So I think those are big issues there. The World Trade Organization, there's an issue that's confronting Africa. There was some members were present at the Bali ministerial last year, where there was a so-called Bali package that was agreed. The developed world is really trying to say that the Doha round, which was supposed to place the needs and interests of developing countries, the heart of the work program, whether it did or not is another question, that this must be junked and we must go another route. Trade facilitation was seen as the first thing, but then trade facilitation was also presented as something we could all work on. There was an agreement on trade facilitation. For South Africa, it doesn't require very much adjustment. It's pretty much in line with what SARS is going to do. But many other African countries are going to have to invest in systems, customs control systems, which are going to require quite large sums of money, but they're going to be subject to legally binding commitments. Now, there was very little by way of solid commitments on funding. There was very little. There was only best endeavor language on things like agriculture, least developed countries, packages, which were also part of the thing. And we as South Africa made an intervention, which we got into the final declaration, saying that the work program after Bali must prioritize turning the best endeavor commitments into binding undertakings. What we've seen since then is little progress on that, on any of those issues. African countries very upset with this whole thing. And then we've got competing narratives on the way ahead for the World Trade Organization. So a whole lot of issues around those. Those are the things I just wanted to draw your attention to. All of those things, I think, will one way or another be on our agenda. Then, just on the broadening participation, it's one of our divisions in the DTI. Our colleagues from Small Business are here. Just to say that, as you know, this new ministry, the work of the DTI on SMMEs and co-ops will be transferred to the new ministry, but as things stand at the moment, we will remain with BEE, and the BEE Advisory Council is focusing on promoting black industrialists, and the DM will lead a task team on that. On CCRD, which is McDonald representing here, I just want to just say the DG will give an indication of the legislation that's coming. A lot of the legislation comes from that division. CCRD is Corporate and Consumer Regulatory Division. But there are a number of issues in liquor and gambling. In liquor, there was an interministerial committee that was operated in the last administration. I was looking at liquor and substance abuse, and I think that we really have to conclude that this is no joke in this country any longer. We've got a serious problem of liquor abuse. And what we're doing up to now is not making it into that. So there will be a number of proposals around tightening up liquor regulation. But of course, the provinces are exclusively responsible for the registration of liquor outlets at retail level. That's been confirmed by the Constitutional Court. That's the case in point. On gambling, there will be a bill on gambling. But I think the issue on gambling is we're getting the proliferation of new forms of gambling, particularly electronic. And in fact, I think a lot of people are jumping the gun, finding loopholes in our law and already offering online gambling of one sort or another. You could just Google and see. Go online gambling in South Africa, see what you get off it. Now, what I think the issue is that we need to take a hard decision in South Africa. What forms of gambling do we want to have in this country? One, from the point of view of yielding the best in terms of job creation, in terms of employment and so on. And what do we do about all these others? For example, I would say that the proliferation of some of this online gambling is going to create a serious competitive threat to the casinos, which are probably the ones where we have more investment, more job creation than elsewhere. Apart from which, those new forms of preying on low-income people, vulnerable people, and so on. So I think that's a real issue that we're going to have to confront. The new lottery operator license will be awarded this year. We've tried to keep a very tight hold on this. Last time round, there was a series of court cases which meant that the lotteries were suspended for 6 months. Maybe it wasn't such a bad thing for low-income players of the lottery, but there wasn't any lottery funds to distribute either. Then we've got an intellectual property policy paper, which we're still finalising. There's going to be a lot of debate around that, but we're still working on that. And then, as I say, this is the major driver of the legislative program. Regulators with boards will now become entities in the DTI. We've looked at this thing called agentization of the state. Why do we have agencies? Why do we have for example, a liquor regulator which sits in the DTI, but the regulator of compulsory specifications has a board? What's the rationale? So actually in the legislation which went through in the last parliament, the board of the National Regulator of Compulsory Specifications is coming into the department. And in the BEE legislation, the BEE commissioner is going to come into the department. So we are already addressing that. And the other agencies that are, in the first instance, regulators, if you are sitting there and you're making adjudications about the awarding of money or something like that, okay, there may be a case for you still to be outside, but regulators, we are bringing regulators back in. Also, we have seen that where we've had issues bad governance, they've been in the agencies outside, so we're bringing a number of those in. On GSSSD, Sarah's division, our mandate, and I think you'll see what the DGs are going to say, we say continuous improvement on all indicators. We want to see less vacancies, shorter turnover, more preference for working in the DTI, shorter turnaround times for incentives, less dropped calls, all of that kind of stuff. We want to see all that move in the same direction. I've taken the view. This continuous improvement is the mantra of Asian industrialists. You make small changes, incrementally they add up to a big change. There's not a magic bullet that's going to solve this, but continuous improvement. And I think we have seen over the last 5 years, we've seen that we have moved up and improved, and we are among some of the best performing government departments. So that's like a strategic overview, very high level. But I hope it's given some sense of where everything's coming from. And the DG will present the annual performance program and plan, and I think that will help. I hope that my presentation has helped you to locate the more detailed stuff that he's going to talk about. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Minister Rob Davies. Thank you. At this point, I'd like to welcome the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee of Small Business, Honourable Ruth Bengu, whom, as we've just learned, as the Minister has just pointed out again, that the budget, majority of it, as I understand, of its budget will come, or most of it, from DTI's budget. Is that correct, Minister? I hope I understood that right.
Well, we'll transfer functions and budget with it. I don't know what else they'll get, but certainly they'll get from us.
The funds follow function. Of course, with the chairperson, the Honourable Ruth Bengu, I thought I saw the whip of the same committee, small business, and that is the Honourable Jitlangoma Mabaso. Thank you very much. And several members of that committee are here. Among them, Mr. Mkongi, he's also, of course, with Trade and Industry, Mr. Bekwa, Honourable Kruger. Am I looking at the right one here? Yes, I am. The Honourable Ladzi, Honourable Meshri. Yes, those are the people here. The ANC, the Democratic Alliance, the Economic Freedom Fighters, and the African Christian Democratic Party. And some staff members are also here with us, and that is Mr. King Kunene, am I right? and your assistant there, or the committee assistant, Ms. Jobodwana. Thank you. The members of Trade and Industry, you're on my left as well. Honourable members of Trade and Industry, there's no need to give your full history, just give your name and the party you are from. And I think it'd be a good idea to start with right here, the whip of the committee, Honourable Chopo.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm Uma Chopo, the whip of Trade and Industry.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I'm Dean McPherson from the Democratic Alliance and from KZN.
Castle Matane, committee member.
Jordan Hill Lewis from the DA.
I'm Anton Alberts from the Freedom Front Plus, and I'm from Gauteng.
I'm Zukile Luyenge, originating from the province of the Eastern Cape, and of course from the African National Congress.
Oh, I'm Bongani Mkwengi. I'm from the Western Cape Province, ANC.
Probably have one member left on Trade and Industry that I can see. I may be wrong, and that's the from the Economic Freedom Fighters. You would just.
Well, my name is Floyd Chivambo from the EFF.
I hope the rest of you are all acknowledged now. And just for the record, Mr. Hermans, the Portfolio Committee Secretary of Trade and Industry, the researcher right at the back, that is Ms. Okwanda Madalani. And then we have also the Assistant in Trade and Industry, is that Mr. Kanyiso Mkise? Full committee secretary, I'm being corrected here. Ms. Hurling, the content specialist advisor, and Mr. Denver Woodington, who's running around, I can't see him, but he is the committee assistant. So my apologies to you, Mr. Mkisa. Thank you. Right. Minister, I know that members would like to engage, but I understand we're going to proceed with the DG's input. Am I right, Mr. October? Right, thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'll take the committee through the DTI's annual performance plan 2014 to 2027. I think as the first input to the committee, thought I'll just give some background to the DTI, how we are structured, our vision, and then look at our budget, and then look some at our key challenges going forward. I think it's very important to state at the beginning what is the aim the department hopes to achieve as an end state. And I think there you can see our vision is a dynamic, industrial and globally competitive economy. But as you can see, there's three words I think that really is the most important ones. It's industrial, and I think the Minister has made the case for how we can only become a prosperous society if we are industrialized. But most importantly, it's globally competitive. Given that in terms of our GDP, I think just under 50% of our GDP is either imports or exports. So we are a small open economy, and it is very important that our firms, and especially our industrial firms, are globally competitive. So you will see lots of our program is aimed at competitiveness. And then the third important point is inclusive growth. As you know, our economy has historically been structured to serve only about 5 million rather than 50 million people. So the growth path that is envisaged is always an inclusive one and including the participation. Then flowing from that vision, you will see where the DTI strategic goals come from. I think the first one is what the Minister dealt with, which is really changing the structure of our economy from being an exporter of raw materials to a value adder and an industrial economy. But the other important goal is to integrate ourselves into global markets, and especially integration onto the African continent And so that is our international dimension, bullet point two. The third one is, as I mentioned, inclusive economy means we must facilitate broad-based black economic empowerment into the economy. So that's the third strategic goal, is empowerment. And then the other one is, as Minister indicated, we have a division, which I'll come to, consumer corporate regulation, but any well-functioning dynamic market economy requires a clear set of rules to operate on, and I think that is where we, this division focus on, is creating a competitive, fair economy. And then the final one is that is to build a effective and professional administration. If we're going to industrialize this economy, we need a developmental state. A development in a state needs, like MITI, Ministry of Trade and Industry in Japan, played a key role in modernizing Japan. We need to build an effective administration to drive the state-led industrial policy. Then, around our strategic goals, you will find that the DTI is structured along these programs and divisions. We've got industrial development as our key program. We've got trade, investment, and exports, broadening participation, the black economic empowerment, regulation, and administration. So you could see how they all link up, and there we spell out in more detail the exact program. The one you will see, which I will go to in later, is Program 6, which is our incentive development administration, because the bulk of our budget and the bulk of our work revolves around supporting the industrial sector through incentives. And so over $5 billion worth of incentives that we give, and it's managed through a specialized division, and that's the Incentive Development Administration Program 6. So before getting into the program in detail, I think I won't spend too much time on this, but just important to notice some points about the economy we face. As the Minister indicated, because we are a small open economy, we are really vulnerable. Either on the if the global economy booms, we become a, there's a big market for our goods, and we can export. But if the economy goes into recession, the global economy, we suffer like we did in the Great Recession. So it's important just to make, I think the key points to make about the context at the moment, 2014, is that whilst there is a recovery from the global recession, it is still what is called moderate. And we don't expect any major uptick in global growth. But some interesting features is firstly the important recovery of the United States, which, as you know, absorbs a large part of our manufactured exports, motor vehicles especially. But here, there's been a turnaround, as mentioned, and it's been driven by industrialization, what they call reshoring in the U.S., bringing back all the firms that relocated from the U.S., but also the shale gas revolution in the U.S. has basically brought down energy prices by up to 30-40%, and therefore they can really reindustrialize, and that's the U.S. There's also a moderate economy in BRICS. But finally, the big savior, I think, for the growth we have is Africa, and the growth on the sub-Saharan Africa, and that is still going strong. I think I won't go in here, but I think everybody knows that whilst we had a very strong quarter at the end of 2013 because of the platinum strike and its implications for manufacturing and other sectors, we've seen a contraction in the first quarter of this year. This slide basically just shows, as we can see, we were about to get out of the we are getting out of the Great Recession, but then we ended up in the first quarter, mainly related to the platinum strike. Employment, you will see in this slide that whilst employment is modestly increasing, non-agricultural employment, and this slide probably gives you a best overview for what is happening in our economy over the past 3 years. As you can see, there is a stabilization and moderate growth in non-agricultural employment. And as the Minister indicated, what we have been able to do is now, from the recession, stabilize the economy and stabilize some key manufacturing sectors. But we haven't yet seen any dramatic growth phase. But if we do, and this is what we will come to, if we are able to scale up our industrial policy interventions, we could have that structural shift in employment from what is called stabilization. Let me then go into the key priorities of the department. I think it's important just to contextualize government planning and especially the link it to the National Development Plan. I think this is the middle slide indicates how our planning program works. As we know, at the high level, we have the National Development Plan, which is really the sort of the guiding document for all government programs. From the National Development Plan, we have government has adopted the 5-year medium-term expenditure framework and strategic framework. So that is the 5-year plan, and out of that 5-year plan, you will see comes our strategic priorities, the APP, which we're presenting now, which is a 3-year plan, and the MTF, which is over 5 years. Out of the medium-term strategic framework, I will take you through it, but arises 21 priorities for government. But I thought it's important just to show that what we have in our annual performance plan and in our MTF is really comes out of IPAP as the core, but mainly derives from government's medium-term strategic framework and from the National Development Plan. As I indicated, from government's 5-year plan for this administration, 2014 to 19, there's 21 priority areas which we'll focus on over the next 5 years. The first one, and I'll just touch on a few because we'll go into detail as the divisions do the presentations, but the most important one is the first one, which is we hope to, in the next 5 years, at a minimum over the next 3 years, launch 3 new special economic zones. As you know, currently we have about 4 operating IDZs, Kucha, East London, Richards Bay, and O.R. Tambo, and we hope to launch 3, the Saldanha, and that's the one we launched last year, and then that's our plan. We hope to have 250 investment projects. Of course, we will implement all the IPAP interventions. The most other important one is what is called here MBAP. It's a Mineral Beneficiation Action Plan. Because of the successful model of the Industrial Policy Action Plan, we now see that model and methodology being used. We're going to have an Agricultural Policy Action Plan, and also we will be spearheading the development of a Mineral Beneficiation Action Plan. And we'll go into some detail later on. The other big one, as mentioned by the Minister, is to hit the 75% localization target for government programs. The other one is Export Council for the continent. As I said, the biggest growing market and the fastest growing market for our manufactured exports is now the continent, and I think it's about, we will be heading to about 25% of our 25% of our exports is now destined for the continent, and it's our major growth area given the growth on the continent. So we will be developing a dedicated export council to drive our value-added exports onto the continent. Then the other pipeline for the 5 years is our investment pipeline of 50 billion. Honourable Chair, you will know that over the past few years we have really turned around the FDI story in the country. We've had some major investments from India, China, and I think the latest UNCTAD report shows that there's almost a doubling of investment in 2013, which was $8 billion of investment. So really we're on an upward trajectory with regard to FDI, and we hope to expand that. And then the other ones already mentioned by the Minister is a tripartite free trade agreement, which we hope to conclude in this administration. And then we also hope to enter into a number of bilateral agreements, especially on the continent. So those are our 21 priorities that you will see reflected in our plans. Just finally to mention, we also, given our target of 75% government procurement must be local, we need to be able to ensure that we have the supply capabilities, that we have domestic suppliers. So we will be developing a specific incentive to help especially black suppliers to enter the supply chain, and that's the development of a supplier development incentive program. Then let me go into then the key interventions going into our program as I highlighted. As I've mentioned, we've mentioned industrial policy. Our biggest work is going to be in the beneficiation area. As the Minister indicated, we've identified five value chains, platinum, mining, machinery, iron and steel, and so forth. And we hope to use exactly the model we use for industrial policy to develop such a very detailed action plan, and we will be kicking off with two big projects in the beneficiation field. Of course, we will continue rolling out the annual policy. Then looking at, as we indicated, the Special Economic Zones Act was adopted a few months ago in Parliament. We will now put into effect the Special Economic Zones. As indicated, we are currently or have indicatively scoped about 10 new special economic zones, and that will be implemented, and we will be doing the accompanying legislation. We will go on with our existing programs, and this one is called THRIP. It's Technology and Human Resource Program. This is where we assist students, researchers, doing research into different industrial areas. And the other program we have is called SPY, which is our support program for industrial innovation. This is anybody who wants to, who has a innovation or wants to develop a new product or a new prototype. We provide those sort of seed funding, startup funding for them to start developing prototypes and doing other kind of research. Those programs will be carried out. We will carry on a tool-making apprenticeship program. This is part of skills development and developing the skills base. And then coming then to a very big program of the department, which is the EMIAS scheme, which is the Export Marketing and Investment Assistance. We hope to assist 950 enterprises. This is where we help companies who want to look at export markets. We then help them with funding to be able to do international market research, to put up exhibitions, and to display their products. And so it's really an export development program, and we hope to cover just under 1,000 companies. This is just an overview of, as I said, the bulk of our work is really giving money to incentivize the private sector to produce locally and to upscale. This is some of our programs. You will see that roughly we support, I think just it's about 450 enterprises you will see there. There's about 100,000 jobs which we will maintain and support, and leverage of about 20 billion rand is in our plan. The Automotive Incentive Program, as Minister indicated already, that program is already running very successfully, and it has already generated over 20 billion rand of investment. We hope to continue, but now get into bigger vehicles, taxis, buses, and so forth. The business processing, I think the Minister covered that. Film and television, we now have a substantial industry that is growing. The other one that maybe hasn't been is the 12i program. We run a tax incentive program which we give for large investments, and we hope to cover another 12 companies. And then the other program, which is the newest one, is the Manufacturing Competitive Enhancement Program. This is for companies who are upgrading and improving their competitiveness. There we hope to help about 350 companies and support about 99,000 jobs. This is our incentives. Then just looking at our interventions in terms of the international front and the African front, as the Minister indicated again, our biggest priority is going to be to consolidate the tripartite free trade area. This area for members covers 26 countries. It's right from Egypt all along the East Coast and then Southern Africa. Covers about 600 million people and US of about 2 trillion US. So it's a massive market we have, which will be a grand free trade area, and as I get it, that will be our priority going forward, and hopefully it will be concluded in the next 12 to 18 months. If we again then look at growing our value-added exports, we have that target of increasing using our incentive programs to 3 billion and our investment facilitation. As I said, there's a difference between, we've got the 5-year projections and then 3-year projections. Then under broadening participation, our BEE program, we know the Parliament passed the Amendment Act, and we will, in this administration, establish the BEE Commission, and the BEE Commission, which will really be a champion for BEE, but also investigate any fronting and any malpractices in the BEE industry. So that will be a big part of our work around the Black Economic Empowerment Program. And then we will also, this program is started about 18 months ago, Incubator Support Program, and we hope to establish another 90 incubators across the country. Incubators is really the support which is most effective for small businesses, where we provide mentorship, facilities, and different forms of support within a secure environment. That's that program. This also just indicates some of the incentives that we have. The other incentives are mainly for industrialization and for different sectors like foam, autos, and so on. This is programs aimed at broadening participation, and there we have the EIP program and then the aquaculture development program. Then in the regulatory sphere, as mentioned, we hope to bring 6 pieces of legislation to Parliament this year, to the National Assembly and to the NCOP. The first one, which will be the first we will be bringing, is called Promotion and Protection of Investment. This is, as colleagues know, we had the bilateral investment treaties, and we will now be having a all-encompassing legislation to protect investment. We will then also be introducing the others, which you see there, Copyright, Liquor Amendment Act, Companies Amendment Act, and then the licensing of the businesses. We will also be doing policy frameworks, especially in liquor gambling in those sectors. We will also be finalizing the regulations, as I indicated, for the Special Economic Zones program. Then I think what we've covered up to now is the different work areas of the department and the key divisions. Let me then just turn to the administration and then the trade, and then I will just quickly look at our division of labor between us and the small business ministry. In terms of, we've stabilized our vacancy rate, and our target is to bring it right down to 6% from our currently at 9. We have about 1,000 staff of about 1,500 in the department, and our vacancy rate is currently just below 10%, and we will work on that. We also have a target for women in senior management positions and a target for people with disabilities. And then, as the champion of small business, we will keep up our record with regard to paying all suppliers within 30 days. Currently, most of our payments are now made within 15 days as the department, and we will try to maintain that record in the next period with regard to the administration. As our deputy minister indicated, a big part will be to take DTI to the factories so that we make our incentives more accessible and the DTI programs more accessible, and that will be our public awareness campaigns. Let me just then turn to our budget and what we have been allocated. This is our budget for the 3-year period of our plan. We currently have a budget of 9.8 billion, and then it will be increasing to 10.9 and then 11.9. The increases you see will mainly be in our Special Economic Zones program. As I indicated, we will be launching definitely a minimum of 3 Special Economic Zones, but hopefully it will be in the 5 to 10 range, and then we have we have allocations from National Treasury within our MTF to be able to scale up those programs, but it's going to need a bit more resources for that. If you look at the DTI budget, as I indicated, you will see incentive development administration, that's the 5.5 billion. So about 58% of our budget is payments for incentives to the private sector, but also under broadening participation and industrial development, you will see a large part of that is also just support to companies as such. But and then it's under a billion which we use for administration, 700,000, and then for the different divisions of the DTI. Just in terms of some of our key, let's say not challenges, but conclusions we can draw from our work going forward. Our biggest issue is going to be the electricity issue. We've seen a number of companies now that had to cut down on production because of shortages of electricity, so that's going to be the biggest area. The Minister dealt with the issue of exchange rate volatility and especially a overvalued currency. We'll be doing work on that. As I said, our biggest area of work is going to be to continue this trend around FDI, to attract much more foreign direct investment into the productive sectors of our economy. And then finally, to really strengthen our focus in terms of Africa, increasing our value-added exports to the continent, but also our work around developing regional value chains. And so on. Let me very quickly then just turn to the small business and for Honourable Chair Bengu. Currently we have programs and we will be transferring all of these programs to the new department, but there's a CEDA technology program which will be transferred with CEDA, and then under CEDA there's a CEDA technology program. So whilst it's still part of our budget, and that's why it's reflected here, it will be handed over. That is the amount of incubators we hope to establish and the enterprises we hope to support. And then there will be the work around the Cooperative Amendment Act and especially the development of the Cooperative Development Agency. What was decided was we need, while CEDA can cover small business, you need a dedicated institution to provide support to cooperatives. And that will be the work that will be done. Then, as you know, we developed the informal sector strategy, and that is to support township businesses. That was also just launched at the start of this year, and that program and will also reside with the small business department. Also, our youth enterprise development program and strategy, as well as the gender and women's empowerment work in the department will be handed over. And then we will also transfer the two major incentives that currently resides in the department. The one is the Cooperative Incentive Scheme. This is where we provide from 350,000 up to R1 million for cooperatives. As I said, we've already budgeted for 431 cooperatives to support, and then the Black Business Supplier Development Program. This program, which is targeted to support over 1,000 enterprises, these two programs with staff and budget will be transferred to the new ministry and the department. Madam Chair, that covers both the work of the department and the government's, the DTI's plan. Thank you.
Thank you very much, DG October, for really underpinning the laser-sharp strategic overview that the Minister had given us earlier on. Those two have come together very well. Now, members, I know that we've been sitting and listening to the department, and we have a choice of having a little tea break. I think we've done with that, and that can roll through as we engage. And we'll turn across to the members of the committee. Two committees, in fact, are here. And let's get that. We have trade and industry, and we also have, as I said, Honourable Ruth Bengu's chairing the small business. So both committees will engage, depending on their focus, of course. Now, what we'll do is we'll initially take, let's try seven hands, and let's not try to do 5 minutes per person. We're not in a debate. Let's try and keep it to 2 to 3 minutes if possible. Oh, I haven't even finished speaking, but I see the hands have jumped. All right, well, okay. Let's do it starting with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I'm not too sure. 7. Right, thank you. Oh, sorry. My apologies, Whip. 8. Well, we'll come in then. You'll come in definitely. Yes, Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you very much, Chair, and to the Minister and the DG. A couple of questions in terms of how your presentations today interact with what's going on at the moment in the South African economy. Firstly, we saw in the paper today the expressions of serious concern by the motor manufacturers about the impact of the NUMSA strike, which started this morning or yesterday, I think, with some of them saying they can last 9 or 10 days, others saying they can last 2 or 3 weeks, but not much more than that. What role is the department playing in government, in cabinet, in trying to reach a speedy conclusion to that strike? Then, also what's been happening, I mean, both the Minister and the DG said that electricity is a major concern, and I think that's absolutely right. It makes South African manufacturing just fundamentally uncompetitive if we have such expensive electricity. But Eskom has requested for a tariff increase above that which was approved by NERSA last year, above the 8%, a cost recovery additional tariff increase. Again, what role is the department playing in opposing that request, and what are the details around that? And then I just wanted to ask you a question about a debate that's been happening in the business papers the last few days with regards to BEE. You will have seen that Minister Ramaphosa made some remarks about the mining charter, and specifically the 26% black ownership requirement in the mining charter. And there was some confusion around how the mining charter interacts with the new code of good practice, and which, in essence, which you know, which one trumps. Now, I remember from the legislation that there is a trumping clause, but of course the difficulty here is that the charter is compulsory because you have to comply with it if you want mining rights, whereas the code of good practice is essentially voluntary. So the question is, which does prevail in that situation, and are you liaising with the Department of Mineral Resources on that score? Because it seems to be adding at this point to a little bit of the policy uncertainty, which we really don't need more of in that sector. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And then we have the Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and to the Minister and DG. Just a couple of questions regarding regulatory bodies like CIPC. I have an email in front of me from a very concerned gentleman that is wanting to start two new businesses which involve job creation. However, for the last 4 weeks, he has received no feedback from CIPC, because they're conducting office renovations and have not bothered to get back to him. He's tried to get through to the Minister's office, but no response from the Private Secretary, Ms. Neertling. I just want to know from the Minister and from the DG what interventions are being made in CIPC, because it would seem that for some time, from the old entity to the new entity, that there has been not a lot of efficiency in that particular body, and that really is at the coalface of allowing entrepreneurs to come into the market, start new businesses, but without the necessary documentation, it is almost impossible to access things like finance and other such things. I also know that from the DG's report that he had said that under key interventions, industrial development, that the SRIP program was going to support 1,458 students. But in the previous financial year, from the budget overview that was sent to us, the same program that was supposed to support 1,350 students, that those two targets were not met by the third quarter. If those targets were not met in the previous financial year, what specific interventions are going to be made to ensure that students, particularly through a program like this, do actually come on board? With regards to the SEZs, I think that those are vitally important to our economy, and I think that we need to do everything that we can to ensure that that they take place, but not just becoming an island of excellence in a barren wasteland. And how are we going to make sure, and I'm going to use the example of Kucha, that it's a wonderful example, but there's very little infrastructure to support it in terms of rail, road, etc. They're frequented with electricity blackouts. And what budget or where is the budget allocation going to come for the new SEZs? Because I'd imagine that there is a big cost behind something like that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable McPherson. Honourable Alberts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Minister, I would just like to know, in terms of your vision, and you spoke a little bit about the industrial economy, and I suppose one can put that against the knowledge economy, that's so-called knowledge economy that seems to be developing in places around the world. What would be, in terms of your vision, be the place for a knowledge economy in South Africa in terms of job creation? And also having a future-oriented economy that will not get left behind in terms of where the economies of the world are going. Secondly, in terms of the red tape problem that we have, and I suppose there you will have to liaise with the Minister for Small Business, in Canada they have these development or small business centres all over the country where entrepreneurs can go, especially poor entrepreneurs can go, and they will get free advice on how to start a business, legal advice, business advice, and also actually incorporate companies for free, get advice regarding intellectual property, and have even financial assistance regarding registering patents, whatever the case may be. Are we looking in the same direction? What we have today is that the poorest of the poor do not have access, do not understand the law, do not have access to the knowledge to start a business. And I think over and above the schooling that they get, which we know is not very good at the moment, they also need to be advised properly outside the schooling context on what their rights are and how they can participate in the economy as entrepreneurs. I think that's quite important to look at. And just lastly, the numbers that you've given on the growth or the increase of non-agricultural employment, I'd just like to know whether that includes the employment created by the state itself, or is that employment created by private industry, and whether it's linked causally to the interventions by the department themselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Alberts. Honourable Chairperson Ruth Bengu.
Thank you very much to both the Minister and the DG for a good presentation. The main intention for us to come here as this portfolio committee was to get an understanding of what work was done by the Department of Trade and Industry in the area of small business development as well as cooperatives. and also to get an understanding of what is it that would be coming on our side so that we can also start engaging with the minister and the department in relation to the work that, to the mandate that has been given to them. I will not have specific questions at this moment, but I have listened carefully and I got an understanding of what is it that the amount of work that has been covered and what is it that is coming to us from trade and industry. We will continue to engage. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. Honourable Mkongi.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. I firstly want to welcome the presentation and the briefing from both the ministers.
Honourable Mkongi, if we could ask you just to adjust the mic or your seating.
Okay, no, thank you very much, Chairperson. I just wanted to say I would like to welcome the presentation from both the minister and the DG. It was more informative, you know, for us as members of parliament. But I think it's very important that we appreciate, firstly, that there is a paradigm shift in terms of thinking and the direction of the state into a government-led industrial policy regime. That is, the minister perhaps to explain further what could be the triggers for that, you know, for that policy shift, and where it can take South Africa to at this critical moment where we face, I mean, number of global shocks, you know, each and every time, you know, that makes our country to be in a back foot in terms of its own development. That is the first one. The second issue that I want us to do good. How deliberate are we going to build this army of black industrialists in particular, I mean in general, and African industrialists in particular? Because if we do not have a strategy, I mean, when do we, are we going to have that strategy? Because as Minister have put it, that the industrialists in South Africa do not represent the demographics of the country. And if we take this and make sure that they support this, some of them, when we put policies, they do what we call a brain drain and run away from this country. How are we going to make sure that we guard against that, that we make sure that we build this army of black industrialists as soon as possible? One of the matters, what issues of the BEE, the broad-based economic empowerment, we are going to check in order to make sure that we are supporting the development of the black industrialists. Because we are having a laws that are there already, and what needs to be strengthened in those laws. One of the things that the minister has raised, the question of the complex, what do you call it, a complex fronting, you know, that is taking place. Which, for me, takes us to the question, what support do we need as a country for localization? What support do we need? Do we need internal or local support, or we need a foreign support to make sure that we succeed in the localization and the value-add approach? Those are just questions that I wanted to raise and the comments. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much, Honourable Mkongi. And now, Honourable Luyenge.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and in appreciating the presentation by both the Minister and the DG, not necessarily because there has been a mention of the Eastern Cape and OR Tambo and Mthatha in particular, in accordance with what the President said. So I'm appreciating the fact that this particular presentation is talking directly to what the NDP entails, to what has been pronounced in the State of the Nation address, coupled with what the DG is saying. the program of this department is actually speaking to what has been politically outlined by the minister. I want to say it's a job well done. Few questions that I have. One, I would appreciate if also the DG can talk to the plight of the department with regard to cases of litigation, if any. And secondly, if the department does have or operate a suspense account, the role of the communities, I mean, a little bit deeper to what has been said, because I'm a civic, I'm an activist of civic, so I would want it to be clear about the role of the communities in the works of the department. I would want that to be clarified further. And also, Minister has spoken about beneficiation. I would appreciate more if the Minister also spoke about the ownership, because as the communities, we don't just want to benefit. But if things go well, let us benefit and also own. Let me just stop the chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Luyenge. Honorable Shivambu.
Thank you very much, Chair. I don't know why the ministry currently refers to the National Development Plan as the basis of the vision, because there is no cogent industrial policy action plan and industrial policy in the NDP. And the job drivers that are identified there do not include most of the issues that are speaking about here. I don't know, maybe it's a mantra, it's a fashion that NDP, NDP, and then you speak about something else. It's one of the things that, because you must understand that when you speak about development and the now developed countries, you speak about countries that have got industrial superiority, they've got more industries as compared to other parts of the world. And so industrial policy is essential to any form of development. So actually, the NDP was supposed to be the National Industrial Plan, and then the other aspects will come out of that in terms of what happens, because it's the most essential component of what you have to deal with. But it's not in the NDP which all of you are speaking about. Number two, the issue of industrial inputs, I hear with regards to the Minerals Beneficiation Action Plan, you're saying that there will be discussions with DMR on reducing the platinum by 10% and everything else. It won't happen. Still, it will not help you to industrialize and beneficiate platinum, because all the existing mining companies, particularly in the platinum sector, they do something called transfer pricing. They sell platinum to their subsidiary companies in the tax havens. They make more money out of that and everything else. It's going to be more difficult. I don't understand why. Don't have to nationalize mines, Minister. I don't understand why you can't pursue a more aggressive industrial policy that is linked to the already existing state-owned mining company to extract platinum, to deal with the issues of the critical PGMs, all of them. And then you then industrialize based on the mineral resources that you can extract from beneath our soils, yourselves. Not to rely on Angola Platinum, on Lonmin, and these other companies to get industrial inputs. And without industrial inputs, there's no industry which is going to go anywhere. So you need to talk about that when you engage with the DMR. I was interested to hear more in terms of what you're going to say about agro-processing. You said you can't speak more about that. What is happening with regards to agro-processing? I mean, you have a manifesto commitment of the ANC and the State of Nation address that you're going to buy 75% of goods and services from South Africa, like locally produced goods and services. Can you expand that to consumer goods and services, to food? The state buys lots of food for school feeding schemes, for hospitals, for prisons and everything else. Can't we expand that and not just encourage local production, but put mechanisms in place to make sure that all the food that the state buys is locally produced? Then the 1 million jobs that you must create in the world food economy won't happen in 2030. Will happen sooner than you anticipate. It's one of the immediate interventions you can make. You can pass regulations to the retail stores, the pick and pay supplies, and all those things, to say that all the food that they trade should be locally produced. Then your problems will be limited. The last issue which I want to speak to, I will speak to other things some other time, is the issue of the status broadly of our trade and tariffs agreements. What are we bound to in terms of the WTO agreements? What are we bound to in terms of other trade agreements that are existing? What is the relationship of the trade and tariff policies that we have and the industrial policy action plan that you have developed? Some of the sectors that we have developed, aren't they going to be undermined by the trade agreements that we have and everything else? I hear that you said that some of the WTO agreements are not signatory to. So like, can you have a sense of what areas are we most vulnerable and what do we do? What strategic substitution do we engage in? Not just strategic tariffs, strategic substitution we engage in to make sure that we protect certain industries that we've identified to industrialize. Those are some of the things that we want to highlight. But we'll speak about the other things in the future. Sure, thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Shivambu. And now we have Honorable Tsopo, the whip of the committee.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, we welcome the presentation from the Minister and the Director General. I do have questions as regards particular areas they presented to us today. The first one is in relation to beneficiation and industrialization. What mechanisms are government employing to support these initiatives? Secondly, what is required for these strategies to be successfully implemented in relation to transport infrastructure, lower administration costs, and skilled labor? Thirdly, what strategies are in place to ensure that these elements are available? And lastly, what strategies are in place to minimize the impact of existing challenges? One of the challenges were also highlighted by members, which is inadequate electricity supply and costs, lengthy strikes, and labor unrest. The second question I have is in relation to decision to change governance structures of regulators with boards. Minister, what is the rationale behind this decision of the process, the benefits of this particular processes, benefits of this particular change? Secondly, how will the new reporting and lines of accountability be structured? Thirdly, how does the minister intend to implement this change? And lastly, what mechanisms will be to ensure that regulators maintain their independence? And my last question is in relation to targets, which the DG talked about, around the senior managers from the side of women and disability, because I thought that the DG will be in the position to tell us progress which the department has made as far as these two sectors are concerned, because we are very interested to see whether are you gender sensitive. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Tsopo. And did have eight, and then someone's hand flew up. Honorable Mabasa, the whip of Small Business Portfolio Committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Comrade Chairperson, and also thanks to Minister and DG for the input. What I wanted to be assisted on is with the establishment of the new Committee on Small Businesses. Should I understand that cooperatives are still seen as a mechanism that runs across all departments, irrespective of the establishment of the new department, so that even when we speak of the SEZ, even when we speak of BBBEE, central to effecting that should be cooperatives? In other words, this is the type of question that I would be asking any department. So I just want to have a feel of how such issues were foreseen. Thanks, Comrade Chair.
Yes, just to mention to others, the previous term, Honourable Mabasa also sat in this committee. His passion was cooperatives. And it's very, for me, it was interesting and valuable that you in the Small Business Portfolio Committee, where one of the foci will be small, you know, the cooperatives itself. Anyway, it does look as if I'm looking around at any new, you know, some of the members who may have joined us from Small Business at the back, but it does look like we have captured all of the hands, Minister, and the questions in that particular regard. Thank you. So it's over to yourself and the department.
Okay, well, I'll start and then I'll let the DG follow, maybe other members. I'm actually going to start with the small business questions because I wasn't aware that, in fact, that they were coming in the first instance, and that they were coming for the purposes that the Chair mentioned. So I think it's fair that we perhaps do say a few things about how we in the DTI saw small business, what we were focusing on, and so on. So let me just start there. And I think that really what we, what I often used to quote was a figure which got in from the department at one stage, was that if there are 7 small businesses in existence in South Africa today, a year from now only 2 of them will continue to be in existence. There's a high turnover rate in small business. What is required to be a successful small business person is that you become an expert at something. You're willing to try and try and try again. You're willing to sacrifice. You're willing to do hard work. And that the role of government is to support people like that, identify and support people like that. Now, the Honourable Alberts was talking about red tape, and that often comes up. But then when he talked about red tape, he was including CEDA in red tape. And I think that red tape and red tape reduction for small business is important, but it's only one thing. The other part of it is that we need to actively support small businesses to grow and develop. And so what did we try to do? We said, well, we have a program for small business, which we've had for many, many years, and I'm sure that the idea of a new ministry is it focuses and is going to improve on this. It looks good on paper, but it hasn't delivered the results. So we said, let us pick out, in line with our other economic priorities, those parts of the small business program which we think can have a higher impact in terms of creating productive, real entrepreneurs in this economy, not people who are middlemen, not people who are looking for instant contracts and are not becoming experts in the area and so on and so forth. Let's try to focus on that. And one of the programs we picked out of this was incubators. An incubator program is typically, as the DG indicated, it's where you have an environment where people start a business. They typically have access to some machinery and equipment. They have access to mentoring. They probably have some formal training and so on. And CEDA was rolling out these incubation programs, and we set them a target to more or less double. And they did it. They achieved more or less that, more or less doubled it. But we actually said that that's not enough because we actually want businesses to become involved. So we put out an appeal to every business organization, and finally we came on an incentive program, the incubation support program, where we provide a matching grant. And we were starting to roll these out. I went and opened the first one that was rolled out. It was in Sasolburg Chemical City, where we were starting to roll these things out. But then we said that has to go along with a real change in the way in which the business environment operates in South Africa, because one of the real opportunities for small businesses, one of the ways that small businesses develop is not just by getting government contracts. It's also by creating a symbiotic relationship between big and small companies around supply and development. So when you go to Asia, you'll see that in there's a place called Toyota City, which is where Toyotas are made, evidently. But there's a stream of small businesses who are in supplier relationships. And so what we said was, this is what we want to encourage. We said, let's turn the tool of BEE into a tool that's going to help us to achieve that. And also to make sure that when we have, as I said, one of the members repeated what I said, that the industrial sector is not representative of the demographics of the country. Can we not use the tools of BEE to make those changes, or at least to contribute? So one of the things we said is that, well, first of all, there's this thing called complex fronting. Not too many times do you find that the cleaner's called the CEO or something like that. That's very crude. Much more somebody's presented with a contract, they think they're going to be on the main board and the management team, and they find they're relegated to being the PR of people for the company, something like that. So we say, well, look, we'll have this commissioner. The commissioner will look at fronting, receive fronting complaints. There's also a statutory definition of fronting in the new legislation. If you're involved in fronting, that you're doing a contract with somebody, you're trying to present yourself as an empowered company, but you're actually not, and you're trying to do it because you want to get some economic benefit, then I'm sorry, it's a form of fraud. There'll be a statutory offence, but we can deal with those matters so that people who are empowered in the main company, if you want to call it that, will be really empowered, will become the managers, will become people that are actually involved in the main business, whatever it may be. But secondly, we said that you can already earn points for supplier development, for enterprise development. We combined that into a single category. We also took skills development, because skills development is fundamental. And we said, if you're not scoring a sub-minimum there, we put ownership in as well because it's not exempt. If you're not scoring a sub-minimum, we'll take you down a place on your overall scorecard. Now, that is still to come in. So it's an attempt to use the BEE tool, along with the incentives, to try to get a change of relationship between big and small company, create more opportunities for people to become real entrepreneurs. That was the first thing that we focused on in the last administration. Secondly, there were cooperatives. In the legislation that came out, we said the defining feature of a cooperative is not whether it's big or small, because in many economies, cooperatives can be big. Cooperative, what defines them, is the collective enterprise. In some countries, the biggest banks are cooperatives. In Spain, Mondragon is a big cooperative. But we said that in agro-processing in South Africa, many of the control boards and things like that were cooperatives. You've got KWV, what does that stand for? Cooperative. And the brand for canned fruit. All of those things were cooperatives. So we said that what defines a cooperative is a collective enterprise. Of course, because it's a collective enterprise, it's particularly accessible to very small entrants. So we said we need a cooperative-focused program that focuses on co-ops, not as a subset of small business, but in their own right. So the legislation that went through establishes a cooperative development agency, a cooperative tribunal to deal with disputes, because very often disputes about management and all of that ends up destroying cooperatives. And then there was, with higher education, a cooperative academy or a series of cooperative academies. Then the other thing we did was we said this thing called the NEBUS. We were going to launch it end of last year. Then we had the tragic passing of Madiba. We delayed it and we launched it this year in Port St. John's, the NEBUS program. What is this saying? It's saying that we've got a huge number of businesses that are currently informal. Up to now, if you want to get support from government, you've got to reach a level of formality. You've got to be VAT compliant, you've got to be paying your tax, you've got to have this or that, the other thing. We said, we want you to get there, but let's not set a condition that before you get there, we don't work with you. So we started off, and the program was going to be two legs. One, in infrastructure. Let's provide a place where people can trade, and we'll support municipalities where people can trade. A place that's economically attractive, that provides minimum facilities, even more than minimum, toilets, childcare, things like that, where people can trade in safety and in conducive way. So that was the first phase, and then eventually we wanted to get to a set of incentives for township businesses. That's what we wanted to do. That was the NEBUS. Then the last thing is that the red tape issue on its own. We launched with COGTA a red tape reduction program, particularly focused on municipalities. And we said, what is red tape? Red tape is not the same. Removing red tape is not the same as deregulation. Red tape is when you have unnecessary regulatory burdens, where you don't ask people, you ask people for documents that you ask them for another process because one part of the office can't be bothered to go and get the documents, so you impose a cost on the business. You ask for unnecessary information. You impose a regulation that's unnecessary. And in many cases, this is to a huge disadvantage and detriment of small businesses with huge costs concern. One of the things that in the BEE codes itself, there was a, if you want a private heavy piece of red tape, which we removed. And that was that companies that were wanting to work with small black companies, because they're working with them because they themselves wanted to earn points for procurement. They were requiring that they go to a verification agency, pay 30 to 40,000 rand to get a certificate to say that they're black. And we thought this was nonsense. So in the new legislation, what we're saying is you have to accept an affidavit. If you think the people are lying, you go to the commissioner. That's the solution. You can't ask them any longer. If you are 100% black-owned, you automatically recognize as level one. If you're 50% plus, you're level two. That's finished and clear. That was what we said. That, in a sort of a nutshell, is what, very briefly, is what we were trying to do. Now, in terms of the new ministry, responsibility for CEDA, or CEDA will transfer. Though we had people in broad in participation dealing with small business promotion and also with co-ops, they will go to the new ministry. That's more broadly what it will be. I mean, the Honourable Mabasa is right, and this is something we're going to have to grapple with. Because that is transferred to the small business ministry doesn't mean that the DTI doesn't have to bother about small business any longer. When we met with the minister and deputy minister, I said, well, agriculture's got a small farmer program. DMR's got a small mining program. It's not only that, but there's provinces have all got programs. Municipalities have all got programs. It can't just be a process of transferring functions to you and then all the rest of us will get it. There's going to be a bigger issue, a broader issue about coordination. One of the things we did in the last administration was that we had this situation where, as I said, at least with provinces, we interacted with provinces. Every province has got a small business support program. Some of them have got more than one. And we had the absurdity where somebody would walk to the office of one and they'd get told, we can't help you. And if they wanted to go to another office dealing with something else, say the CEDA office, in one case they had to go 200 kilometers to the other place. And we can't have it that you come there, can't help you, sorry, go to CEDA, it's 200 k's away. So we said at the very least people don't have to know our acronyms. They don't have to know who the agencies belong to. Can't they go into any agency and get information about every program that's available? And actually we've gone quite a long way to do that, at least with the provinces. Not with the metros yet, but the provinces. So I think you'll see there's quite a bit of work done on that. So you can at least walk into the the Gauteng propeller or something and get information about the CEDA programs, that sort of thing. You can at least do that now. So I think that is at least a step. But the coordination, I think, is going to be one of the big challenges for the Ministry of Small Business, because quite a lot of small business support was fragmented across bits of government, not only national but also at other spheres. So that's, I think, is to try to rectify for what we didn't say, because we didn't know that you were coming with that expectation. Now let me come back to the other questions. Honourable Hill Lewis. Well, the NUMSA strike and then long strikes. Well, of course, we all know that the platinum strike caused damage to the economy. I think it would be foolish for anybody to say it didn't. One of the problems with the platinum strike was its length, because it had an impact, a negative impact on the workers as well as also on the industry, on exports and everything else. Lots of knock-on effects. So I think we need to be a bit measured about
you know, of course at the beginning of a strike, everyone is going to throw up their hands and say, this is going to have huge damage. You know, last year there was the motor industry strike. And the thing about the motor industry strike was it was a strike in the original equipment manufacturers, followed by a strike in components, and each one impacted on the other. So in fact, instead of, this is what BMW, which was the most vocal about that, had to say, they said, well, they can take a 3-week strike, but they didn't want a 6-week strike, because that's what they effectively had last year. But I went to the opening of the Mercedes-Benz plant in East London earlier this year. And Mercedes-Benz had the best financial results and the best production results because after the strike, they did a deal with NUMSA Local, and they actually got them to work overtime and everything, and they clawed back all the production they'd lost during the strike. So I think we need to not throw up our hands. We don't know where this strike is going at this point. And to answer the question directly, what role will the department play? Well, we haven't been asked to play yet. The role that will be played will be led by the Department of Labor at this point in time. If we're asked to play a role, we'll consider it, but I don't think that we are actually experts at labor relations facilitation. We obviously want all parties to settle as quickly as they can and have a shorter strike rather than a longer strike, because we want to make sure that the performance of the industrial economy moves ahead. That's the first thing. The second thing on the electricity. On the electricity, I think there are two levels of problems. And the two levels of problems are that we have quite a lot of infrastructure problems, even at local municipal level, where we have a lot of outages because there are breakdowns in transmission services and lines and things like that. And then we've got the investment that is happening, and the investment that is happening based on tariff increases. I think the Eskom tariff increase is just about bearable. But then on top of that, you get a municipal loading. And we tend to find that where there's a small town, and the small town has one or two industrial customers, and the loading is very, very high. So our interventions in these discussions and debates are to say, well, we need to find solutions that recognize that what we've got to do is insulate poor households, for sure. No question about that. But also ensures minimal disruption to industrial production. I've been saying myself on a number of occasions, I think we've got the wrong slogan, keep the lights on. Eskom must keep the lights on, because what that means is it means that, well, you remember when there was the first load shedding, everyone was saying, we've got all these office blocks and shopping centers that are keeping the lights on. Now we don't bother about that. We think it's good if the lights are on. And actually what is happening behind the scenes is that industrial customers are getting a subsidy to turn off the electricity to stop production. Now that is a problem. That is a problem in this economy. So that's why the president has put down as a first priority is solving the electricity issue. That's why he's put it down. We will play a role in that, and our role will be to say, there are a few things that we're doing. We have got a standard in place for energy efficiency, which is it's run by us. It's called Clean Production. Energy efficiency and clean production are key elements of competitiveness around the world, whether we like it or not now. And people can get a qualified for a certificate. We think that should be recognized in terms of things like electricity tariffs. We think we've got to address this question of the municipal charges, because we are finding that it can have a perverse effect. We want to promote industrial decentralization. But in fact, what happens is that people are turning around to us and saying, we're not going to go into a small town anymore, we're going to Gauteng, because it's less of a problem there. So I think those are some of the issues. But I think that just to say, we are extremely involved, and we are extremely involved in solving this issue, because we know that this is one of the biggest constraints on manufacturing development in this country. I think we should again put this into some proportion. I went to Japan where the issue was raised. Now in Japan, after Fukushima, I don't know if you go there, they've got something called Cool Biz in summer, where they come dressed in shorts, no ties and jackets, because they don't want to turn the air conditioning on. That's the state of energy in Japan. And you know, they're raising this. I say, well, compared to you, we're a lot better off. But still, we need to improve and address the electricity thing, and we are seriously involved in this. I think on the mining charter and the codes,
Well, the legislation says that it is this BE that is the one that trumps. That's what it says. But we'll have to engage on those because the mining charter legislation predated the BE legislation, but we'll have to engage. Maybe the DG wants to say a bit more on that. On the question of the company's intellectual property commission, I want to say that notwithstanding, from time to time, there will be somebody will complain that this or that didn't get dealt with. If that happens and they come to our office, I don't know, he said they went to Inzanietling. I don't know what the story was there, but we normally pass those things onto SIPCO themselves and ask them to attend to them. And sometimes people email me, and when they email me, we don't just ignore it, I don't just delete it, we follow them through. But I want to say that notwithstanding the fact that from time to time there will be some issues like this, the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission has undergone a massive turnaround to the better. When we took over in 2009, we faced an issue of serious corruption in its predecessor, Cipro. There was an ICT contract which we lapsed. Took a lot of flack for it, by the way. Didn't have all the press gung-ho for us because we were fighting corruption. Didn't have every process that we were involved in going easily, but we took the decision that we were not going to go ahead with this contract, and we lapsed the contract. And then we decided that we put in place an acting CEO who did quite a good job in stabilizing, but we took the decision that we would go and implement the New Companies Act and hand a rather serious poison chalice to the new commissioner, who I think has done a good job in turning this institution around. I think it's a lot better than it was. And by the way, it is not very difficult to register a company in South Africa now. You can walk into First National Bank, open a bank account, and we want to work with all the other banks as well, and I believe a number of others are coming on board now. You pay, I think it's 150, is it 200 rand, something like that. You pay that, and your company is registered. You have to wait a bit longer for a name. You want to call yourself Pick and Pay, we obviously have to check that somebody else hasn't used that name. But you can register, you can start operating on the basis of the number, your company. So I think there's a substantial reduction in red tape around company registration. So, I mean, I think the committee needs to engage on that. On the question of the SEZ budget, I think the DG already talked about that. A large part of the increased budget we have will go to support the SEZ program, and there's a number of them on the cards. I think I can mention already one of them. We will be launching industrial development zone in Dubai Trade Port, in Kinshasa, but that will be launched in due course. Decisions have all been taken. That's there, and then there is also out for public comment is an industrial development zone. You see, industrial development zone using the old legislation, industrial development zone in Harrismith in the Free State. So those are two of the SEZs that were being supported by the provinces. So we are moving on that. And I think the figures on the TRIP, I'm going to leave that to the DG. On the knowledge economy, what's the knowledge economy? I think if the knowledge economy means that there is a higher level of knowledge in every aspect of the production process, I don't have any problem about that. I think that is what I said as well. I said that the way we are moving in the second machine age is we're moving towards conceptual labor, higher levels of knowledge, higher levels of conceptual capacity, and less opportunities for straight routine pick and shovel unskilled type work. That is unfortunately the way the world is moving. What does that mean? It means we have to upskill our people, train people, focus very heavily on education and training. Now we are not an education and training department, but damn it, we've invested in it. We've invested in not for our own staff, but also we've supported, for example, the Nuclear Energy Company of South Africa. A number of programs around things like that, as well as things like the incubation programs, raise the level of skills and so on. But if sometimes the knowledge economy means what I said before, post-industrial, let's just forget about industry and go for services. Well, the United Kingdom thought they were going that way. And concretely, they thought that the City of London was going to crack it for them and they could let the rest of the manufacturing economy go. Well, they don't think that now. They tried to recover their industrial economy. And they think they made a mistake. Germany didn't do that, and Germany is performing quite a lot better. So I think the industrial economy counts, even though there's a higher level on that. I think I've dealt with the red tape. Maybe the DG can deal with a non-agricultural employment statistic. I think it probably does include the state. But that's anyway, most of the employment in this country comes from the private sector. I think that's the fact of the matter. On the triggers for the industrial economy, I think I actually gave those in the thing. I think we were saying that we've got a domain of action which we've identified, various measures we can use and have been using, and then to move on to a higher plane, we said there were a number of things: the infrastructure program, the beneficiation, the regional integration, the more robust engagement of leading companies. Those are the things that we think are the triggers. And the black industrialists, I think some of the BEE measures, some of the SMME programs, they were all intended to move in that direction. But then we have the BEE Advisory Council, which operates under the president, has also started a piece of work on black industrialists. And then we've given the DM a task to develop a strategy framework for us on this issue, because we do think it's quite critical. And the localization question, it links in with what the Honourable Chief Ambu raised. He asked us, what have we signed and what have we not signed that limits us? Well, let me say that in the World Trade Organization, there are two things that apply to localization. One is the one I mentioned, the optional protocol on transparency in government procurement. If we sign that, it's what's called a plurilateral. We say that everybody else who signed it will have the same access to government procurement. In other words, all the developed countries, I'm not sure if China, I think China signed it. If I was China, I'd sign it I'm rushing to sign it. So imagine they probably have. That means that what you say is you say that all of them have equal access to any procurement decision. You can't discriminate against them. We'd have to import. That's what it says. We've not signed it, we won't sign it. I've said often enough, somebody else will have to sign it because yours truly is not ever going to sign it. So that's the point there. So as long as we don't sign it, we are free to take a decision when we come to public purchases to buy local. Okay. The other one that counts, which is a constraint, is something called the trade-related investment measures, TRIMs. That stops us doing the same in the private sector. We can't turn around to ShopRite Checkers and say you can only buy fruit that comes from South Africa. If we do that, we're in violation of that. They take us to a dispute mechanism. They can impose sanctions against us. And the sanctions might be retaliation. So if we said we aren't going to take European fruit, I can't imagine it will be too long before we get into the dispute mechanism. They say, okay, we don't take your oranges, where there are 80,000 jobs at stake. I know that because we are fighting with them over citrus black spot. So that's where it would happen. And I'll underscore it again. In the Trade Development Cooperation Agreement, we said we would not impose export taxes. It's a bilateral with the European Union. However, we've clawed back some of that policy space. It's not much, but it's better. We've clawed back some of that in the draft Economic Partnership Agreement. Whether we use it or not is another question. Mm-hmm. So I think the debate between us was, you think that changing the ownership in the mining industry is critical. We launched the SIMS, state intervention in the mining sector, where the focus was on beneficiation, value addition, things like that. Ownership follows from that. I don't know if there's enough cadres in the economic freedom fighters. If we were to nationalize, particularly say without compensation, so nationalize without compensation, we'd have all the South African shipments abroad, every property that's owned abroad would be seized to settle the debts. But if we have enough cadres in the EFF to run all the mines, I'm not sure we do. So the priority, I don't think, is that. The priority is to use instruments that are at our disposal to ensure that we create a new competitive advantage in South Africa based on the fact that we have mineral wealth. Now, I think there's, you know, let's see, let's try it. We said we'll have an SEZ. There'll be a set of incentives on the SEZ. And then there's a set of tools coming from the MPRDA that we can also use to try to ensure that we get a discounted price for platinum that's going to make these projects happen. We can't be saying to people in the SEZ, you can have platinum, but it's going to be at the same price as if you were sitting in London, import parity pricing. Can't be that. It has to be at a discount. I think that's what we have to do there. Then I think that the question of I think we would have to I know there's a there is transfer pricing that takes place in this economy. I'll give you one case that I know is absolutely substantiated, and that is when it comes to the clothing imports. There's a 60% differentiation between the declared value of clothes exported from China and what's declared at customs. There's serious under-invoicing taking place. That happens. What have we done? It's in our sort of in our domain, but it's with we developed a reference price system with SARS. So if somebody comes in and says, "Well, here's a jacket, and the jacket is 10 rand, and therefore the duty is 40% on 10 rand, which is 4 rand," the customs officer will say, "Well, a jacket doesn't cost 10 rand." So there's a reference price system. So we've at least put that in place. There's some very big questions about what's called tax erosion and base shifting, which is, I think, what you're talking about, where multinationals do all kinds of complex transactions and things like that, and they don't pay any tax locally, stuff like that. These are realities, names of the game. I think we're trying to get on top of some of that. I don't think that we should just accept that it's like that and it's going to stay like that. I think that we actually need to combat it where we find evidence of that. And then I think the approach to the NDP, the NDP defines our vision. Where are we going? I don't think the NDP is something that is the you know, we shouldn't have a Talmudic approach to it. If the NDP is perfectly compatible, the vision, with industrial policy, and we recognise industrial policy as a component of the medium-term strategic framework. That's what it is. It isn't because we said we adopt the NDP that we said we're kicking out IPAP. IPAP is there. So I think that it's that approach. And then where are we now? I think I'm getting close to the end here. Oh yes, the Honourable Tsopo, I think you were talking about the de-agentisation. You know, one thing I've learned being in this job is when somebody says, "I need to be independent to do this job," ask some hard questions. Because people can ask to be super independent because they want to loot the institution, not because they want to do a better job sometimes. That is my experience. So I think we ask ourselves a question: what is the level of independence that you require to do your job? Do you need a board to be administering compulsory standards, to be setting compulsory standards, and to be following up and dealing with people that are not complying with that? Do you need a board? A board, by the way, not the current, not the outgoing board, but two away, was actually involved in a lot of maladministration and corruption, which we had to clamp down on. Why do you need a board? What is the rationale for that? Why do we have a board there, and we don't have a board for the liquor regulator? Now, each of them, and it was written in the law, for example, on BEE, it was written in this law, they're supposed to act without fear or favor. It's not that because they come into the department, the minister's going to say, "It's my friend here, just let them off." It doesn't work like that. They're supposed to act without fear or favor. Does it make a difference if they're sitting over there and I won't give a phone call and say, "Let my friend off here"? if they've got a board or not. Doesn't really. So that's what we've done. So they will be enjoined to act without fear or favour, but administratively they'll sit in the department without a board. We'll save all the costs and expenses that go along with that. We have an institution like the Bureau of Standards, where they are taking money from the public, they are setting standards and things like that. Then there's a case for them having a board, and we'll continue to have a board. But when we talk about regulators as such, one of the ones we're going to have a debate is the National Gambling Board. Unlike the provincial gambling boards, it doesn't issue licenses. It needs to be a national gambling regulator. And so we're talking about making that kind of change. So I think those are the points about that. And then I think I've answered most of the other questions. I don't know. DG, you can take the rest.
Yes. Thanks. Just very briefly, let me firstly deal with the question about the THRIP, the Human Resources Program. Currently, and I think this relates to the agentization, currently this program is managed for us by the National Research Foundation, and they, as you know, run hundreds of programs. We are currently bringing that program back into the department, so we have direct control, and we don't have to sort of have an MOU with the NRF. We will, and that's why we will be able to ensure that the program is run much more effectively, efficiently, but also that it's aligned to industrial research and, as I indicated, supporting students engaged in things like beneficiation and so on. With regards, I think a point was raised around the budget, and especially for the new infrastructure we're going to need in the zones. Our budget currently, as I indicated, is that for 2014-2015, we've got 650 million allocated to the special economic zones. Then for the next year, 2015-2016, we move to 1.6 billion, which is about a billion rand increase, and then we move to 1.8 billion. Now, as we've been explaining, this is going to be one of our major programs, is going to be the special economic zones. So we think we'll be able to, as I said, but when we to manage now, because we're busy in the stage of just bulk infrastructure, and we're busy with the feasibility studies in most of these zones. But as from the next outer years, we are going to, and we will be applying for an adjustment to increase the amount for, and that is what we will be engaging our committee on, especially is to really fight our corner for greater budget for this area of special economic zones. As I said, we've got an amount. I think ministers covered the question of the BEE and the MPRDA amendments. I think the ministers, our minister and minister of DMR, is already engaged on some of the amendments, and the director generals are meeting on Thursday. But the way I understand it, most of the discussion is around the oil and gas sector, and then around the beneficiation or the pricing of the inputs for developmental pricing. Those are the issues we're looking at. But currently our position is that we take it that the targets of 25-26% as set in the codes is what is applicable at the moment. I think most of the other issues was dealt with. I think Honourable Mukongi raised a question just about the triggers and about what are the instruments we're going to be using to launch these beneficiation. There's two, as I said, we've identified the six value chains for beneficiation, platinum, iron ore, and so on. What we're going to be doing is we'll be developing action plan for each one. Then we are looking at budget now of about 10 million rand for each subsector develop in clusters. As Minister mentioned, we've got sort of three areas of support we give. The one is the incubator, which is really for small businesses to be supported. Then we've got clusters, which has worked very well in the auto industry and the clothing sector, where you get firms in the same industry cooperating together, giving access to markets and so on. These industrial clusters is a mechanism, and then at the high level we have the special economic zones. So we have three. Also under the middle sector is we going to incorporating industrial parks, business parks, and especially our question raised by Dr. Luyenge about how we're going to engage closer with communities and especially businesses in townships and in depressed rural areas like your Dimbazas, Potsabalos, and so on. And there we're going to use the revitalization of industrial areas as one of the mechanisms for that. I think, Honourable Shivambu, I think I think ministers covered most of it, but just to emphasize, the two areas about where we see growth in the industrialization area is basically agro-processing and then the metal and engineering capital equipment sector. Those are the two big areas that we do it. As I said, we do have quite a substantial program ourselves in the agro-processing, but we are also working with the Department of Agriculture on, and they've got a draft agricultural policy action plan, and that is where that is the target of creating the million jobs. So we are cooperating with regard to obviously adding value to those food, but you're right, that is a very strategic sector we will be focusing on. I think just on the targets by Honourable Tsopo, we're standing at, in terms of women in senior management positions, currently we're standing at 44%. According to the Department of Labour, we're at the top end in terms of other government departments, but we have, a general government-wide target of moving towards 50%. And under the current APP, we've put in a target of 46.5% to reach. But as you said, we are under instruction. Our former deputy minister has just joined us now, the deputy minister of small business. And as I said, so we do have very strong targets for women empowerment. And then just finally, Honourable Mbasa has raised the important point about co-ops, that obviously the department, especially, we will be developing programs for incentive program for government procurement, but also we're looking at especially access to markets, not only for small businesses, but even for black businesses in general. And I think there we'll have strong cooperation with especially secondary cooperatives, where we will be working very closely with the small business ministry on how we can use all our incentive programs to drive cooperatives. So you're right, it won't just be a function for only one ministry to champion, but for all government. Thank you.
Yes, Minister.
Sorry, I forgot the one bit the DG did answer a bit of it about agro-processing and also about how do we deal with food imports. I think the thing is that agro-processing can make a very significant contribution to driving agriculture. We have a number of agro-processing investments which would like to increase their agricultural inputs, and I think the fact that they exist helps that agricultural production. Likewise, there's a new technology which we've been supporting of small-scale maize milling, which I think creates the opportunity for local communities to have local production of high-quality maize meal, which means that the price of the maize meal doesn't have to factor in the price of taking the maize up to Gauteng and bringing it back again, which is the current situation. So those are a couple of things there. And then, of course, I think implicit in the figures that I gave for the EU is that we have seen a surge of agricultural imports, including processed food products in South Africa. How do we deal with that? Well, some of it is having the courage to use the policy space that's available to us in terms of tariffs. We've done that in chicken. We've done that we adjusted the reference price in sugar recently. Both of those where the sectors are vulnerable, but not just to leave it at that, because we've also said that the local chicken industry, we want to see if we see any uncompetitive behavior, we'll go back and review the tariff. And we also want to see, look at things like the brining, as we don't want local consumers to be having to buy salt water, they have to buy chicken. So there are a few things like that. I think that we've also been talking, as the DG said, to agriculture, the relationship with IPAP and APAP. We also work with them quite a lot on some of the trade policy instruments. And what we see, and I think let's be honest about this, is that the issues in agricultural trade are not so much any longer about tariffs, they're about non-tariff barriers. The citrus black spot is a case in point. I'm not going to say anything more than I will need a lot of persuasion that this is about protecting consumers in the European Union or producers in the European Union from some disease imported from South Africa. Because we know that you cannot harm consumers through that. And the science tells us that it's not even proven that you can actually transmit it from a peel of an imported orange into an orchard. We said, if that is the case, if that is the fear, can we have a differentiated regime? Can we not have one regime for Northern Europe, where there's no citrus grown, which is the UK, Holland, and Scandinavia, and so on, and a different one for Southern Europe, where there are citrus orchards? We didn't get that. We've got to raise in the standards, and I think you can see every now and again the industry doesn't want to say it very directly, but they are concerned, and I said, I am going to need a lot of persuasion. My good friend Carl de Goed is going to have to spend hours and hours and hours to persuade me that this is really to defend the sanitary and phytosanitary standards in Europe and not to keep out products from the largest export of citrus products. That's the name of the game. That's where we are in terms of the game. And so together with agriculture, we want to be much more agile. We have to use the policy instruments at our disposal, identify them, and not lack the courage to use them. I think that's really where we need to be at. But I think we also need to be aware that I had this debate with the Honourable Shivambu when we were on the TV. If we were to say, okay, we're going to ban food imports, even if in some long-term way we were able to substitute the production of all the things that we import, which I'm not sure is the case, even if we were able to do that, for example, wheat, I'm not sure we would be able to do that. But even if we were, there would be a time lag. And the immediate retaliation would be that every single export product of ours would be banned. So if we said we're not going to take any products from Europe, they'd say, right, no wine, no fruit from South Africa. That's what they'd say. Simple as that. And I think that we'd find that people would be thrown out of their jobs in those sectors very quickly, and it would take some time before there was any chance. So I think that really those things are high risk, even if we were going to go there. So what we'd have to do is we have to be intelligent and use the tools at our disposal in a strategic way. That's what we're going to try to do, and that's what we have been doing, and I think with a degree of success, but we need to do better. Thanks.
Honourable members, no, just a minute. We're not going to prevent anyone from asking more questions, but I would like to welcome the Deputy Minister of the Small Business Ministry, the Honourable Elizabeth Tebete, who's engaged with the Committee of Trade and Industry over many years, and the last term was the Deputy Minister, one of the Deputy Ministers in Trade and Industry. So, you've moved across, and I'm sure your carriage take across all the information and experience that you have, and the way that you worked with us, I have no doubt you'll engage the small and medium business portfolio committee. We did clarify with the minister earlier, because we did get an apology about the flight, etc., and she has indicated that she will not speak now. Am I correct? This is what the Portfolio Committee Secretary tells me. But we welcome you, and as you see there, the Honourable Chairperson Ruth Bengu and the Honourable Whip Jiglangoma Mabasa and the committee were here in full force hearing what Trade and Industry was saying. We, of course, a lot of the functions were captured before. Now, we are going to have a short tea break, after which there will be an opportunity for further questions and comments. So we're nowhere near the end of the session. I'm sure you can see that. But I do want to also point out that apart from the full membership of DTI here, not the full, but perhaps the key players in this area, we also have a number of people, Minister, Deputy Ministers, DG, and committee, Honourable Committee members from the media, the diplomatic area, the embassies, consul generals, issues such as SASMED, you know, the Small and Medium Enterprise Federation. We have regulatory people, the Tobacco Institute. We have, as I said, media, legislative assistance. And I should just mention now that the legislative assistant of the Honorable Mario Ambrosini, there was some slip-up in handing in his apology. He will be handing it in writing. The member is a full member, Honorable Ambrosini, of this committee. He is on extended sick leave as at the moment. And then we have, of course, the business and private sector here, as well as interns from NGOs, PMG, Parliamentary Monitoring Group, a lot of the consul generals here, I suppose the economic advisors, and the media. So a lot of interest being shown by the different sectors of society in the work that we're undertaking at the moment in Parliament. So as I said, there will be a short tea break, really just to wet your whistle, you know, 10 minutes and back we track. Okay, bring your cups back. Right, thanks.